All right, let's get going. We have the sign-up sheet for public comment specific to next steps for water taping, please. Okay, so we're going to have to keep this to 3 minutes. We've got 18 people signed up. The first person up is Bill Monahan.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the board. My name is Bill Monahan and I represent Rainier. Rainier owns 328,000 acres in Washington of timberlands, with the majority of our ownership on the coast, much of it in the Olympic Peninsula. We've operated in the state for 91 years. With our ownership, we certainly have our share, or are blessed with our share of RMAP and streams. We infuse these rural coastal communities with $60 to $100 million annually in the form of payments to contractors, loggers, haulers, reforestation contractors, and road contractors. We continue to operate in Washington and look for opportunities to grow here because we believe there is regulatory consistency. The regulatory consistency is essential to landowners making investments when internal rates of return are in the modest single digits and are realized over a long time horizon. Businesses need that certainty, and we certainly do with our long-term investments in capital and risk. So why do we think Washington provides this? A couple reasons. One of the four goals in the Forest and Fish Report, one of them is to keep the timber industry economically viable in the state of Washington. This idea of balance between timber and other natural resources, such as fish and clean water, is inherent in the Forest Practices Habitat Conservation Plan. Additionally, the TFW process itself, whereby science-based adaptive management is required for development of new rules or board manual. Goals of maintaining accuracy and minimizing error means that the process of change can be slow. We've heard a lot about that today. The process requires patience and scientific justification. Stream typing is an example of this process. We have operated under existing interim rules for over a decade now. There seems to be a little bit of a sense of the sky is falling over stream typing under the existing rules. So I wanted to talk about Rainier's experience with the existing stream typing rules and why they've been working. And I evidence this by the following. First, our stream survey data from 2006 to 2014 shows that the FN break has averaged 225 feet beyond nose of the last fish with a high of 1,800 feet. Second, a study in 2013 to review upcoming 2014 and 2015 harvest units found that stream typing had resulted in the addition of upgrade from type N to type F of 121,000 feet of stream. We used either protocol survey or forest practices type F physical rules to make these determinations. Over that same harvest block period, we downgraded from type F to type N only 6,000 feet of stream. This means upgrade on 95% of the stream length and downgrade on only 5%. It is generally agreed by stakeholders who conduct WTM reviews in the field, including landowners, tribes, ecology, and WDFW staff, that over 95% of the time there is consensus on where the FN break should be. Finally, the debate in the field is over the very last bit of fish habitat that might be used by fish, and in reality that happens on a very small percentage of stream segments. We've talked a lot about RMAP today. I wanted to share with you Rainier's commitment and what our accomplishments have been. Since 2006, Rainier has installed 579 fish passable structures, opening up 142 miles of fish passage. This hasn't been cheap. Before completion, we will have spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 million. So it's important to us that that commitment and those agreements are honored around RMF. All that said, I don't believe the sky is falling on water tightening. I like what the staff recommendations were today. And so I guess in opposition of that, if there is an overreaction to issue, for example, going to default physicals, it would not be balanced and is not supported by the concept of shared risk. At least for Rainier's ownership, there would be a steep cost in protecting reaches of streams that there have never been and will never be any fish. In conclusion, lots of consensus has come about through technical group and work at policy. As we've heard from other folks today, I believe we should embrace the consensus process and continue to let science help us through the remaining areas of non-consensus to get an accurate and balanced result. Thank you for the opportunity today.
Ken Wentz.
Good morning. I'm a small landowner from Grace Harbor County. And together with my brothers, we own Lentz Brothers Tree Farms. And with our cousins, we own about 990 acres on 9 parcels in Grace Harbor County. Firstly, I'm a forestry graduate from the University of Washington in 1974, and went to work for a major timber company and spent my entire career, 35 years, as a forest engineer, implementing every version of the forest practice rules that's been in existence. My concern with this is that we call the regulatory creep as from where we started and as we continue to creep up the fish-bearing streams and adding more fish habitat, the impact that that has on our tree farming. It's not only the added, for every 200 feet you go up the stream, we lose an acre, we lose control of an acre. And that acre can run anywhere from $10,000 to $25,000 just in timber value. And then you got the added expense of loss of access and the added cost of managing that timberland. And all these costs start to weigh heavy on our decision as a second generation tree farmer. We started the tree farm, my dad and my uncle, back in the 50s. And my brothers and I have been managing it from the late 80s. And we're looking at the third generation. And it's getting close. And as this uncertainty of this regulatory climate and as things seem to be creeping only one direction, further up the streams and more onerous and restrictive rules and regulations, the decision to pass it on becomes not an easy one. The last thing we would want to do is sell the tree farm. But as we look at the burden of passing it on to the next generation, becomes a real consideration. So probably in the next 10 years, this is going to happen. We're going to have the possibility of either converting some of the tree farm where to a higher and better use where that's possible, or selling is becoming a real possibility because we don't want to pass on to the next generation what could be a burden to them. We'd like to keep it as a benefit. And the tree farming's been in our family for 70 years. And the next generation is more than willing to take on managing that tree farm, but if it becomes a burden, we're going to have to look at other options. So as you consider, it doesn't seem like much as you move up the restrictions further upstream, it has a large impact on us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ken. Ken and Bonnie Miller.
For the record, I'm Ken Miller, and this is my wife, Bonnie Miller. We have a tree farm just south of here. Representing the Washington Farm Forestry Association. I want to start out really by appreciating staff and particularly Mark Engel's efforts. From my viewpoint, working with Mark for a number of years, he's an honest broker, and I think that's the role that DNR needs to be playing, continues to play in this process. On the other hand, for small landowners trying to understand all this stuff and throwing it in at the last minute when we've set up preparations and spend a lot of time trying to give a good message here, it's really tough. I got to be honest with you, I don't understand this. I suspect some of you don't understand it, but I'm going to trust Steve Barnemeyer, who also represents smalls, to say, hey, yeah, that's okay or not. But bottom line, it still feels like, as Ken just mentioned, still feels like it's creeping upstream to me. So we're going to continue on with the our presentations we had it. So I don't really, as I indicated, I don't really understand very well the end of fish habitat debate, but I suspect some of you are similarly confused. To me, it's like the old burger advertisement, where's the beef? Here's my take on the conflict. Imagine five experts separately using their best professional judgment to put a stake in the ground at the end of fish habitat. It's likely you'd end up with five different locations selected. The beef and policy arena, as I understand it, falls into three camps. Those that may rightly think that some folks are stopping at the end of fish rather than the end of habitat. To the extent that that's true, this would be a compliance issue, not a rule issue. The larger camp of folks simply want the experts who are willing to work together to better define what to look for in determining the end of habitat to reduce the professional variability. Five experts still will likely not end up in the same spot, but there will be less differences in where they mark the ground, and the average location is probably going to be about the same. So I do support what I believe is embodied in going forward in the industry recommendation, and it kind of sounds like that's where DNR's now advocating. The third and smaller or bigger camp, depending on how you all interpret the votes in policy, similarly also want less variability in the expert findings, but also appears that they want to move the average point, shift it upstream by redefining likely to mean as little as a 20% chance for potential habitat. And again, it's changed now, so I'm not sure what it all means. But for us, moving the breakpoint further upstream, especially without science or answering the question, where's the beef, clearly breaks the spirit and requirements of forest and fish to the adaptive management and the adaptive management program. To smalls, this appears simply as a naked grab for more of our 50-year crop. We are typically on flatter ground where the stake would more likely move further upstream than industry, which would invoke the small business economic impact study, probable finding of disproportionate impact, and all that entails, perhaps including even more broken mitigation commitments to smalls. I recall the chair championing functions are us and to rightly describe what alternate plans in the adaptive management program is all about. The end result of moving the state further upstream will be an addition of up to 200 foot buffers, that's 400 feet total, on itty bitty streams, where, in my opinion, advocates couldn't possibly pass the silly grin test trying to demonstrate what functions weren't already being protected. So again, this whole issue has been a moving target up to the last minute, making it really hard for a meaningful public comment to the spot where we're at today. It's another disproportionate impact on smalls. I and my able assistant bride for the last 52 years have been asked to share some of the printable small forest landowner comments that we've received. And so I'll give you just a real brief flavor of what they are, and then Bonnie's going to read the most of the last one that I think really sends home the message of where smalls are really at. So here's one from a Western Region Tree Farmer of the Year. You know, they lost about 50% of their parcel, and they say, and along with a lot of other stuff that you'll get, instead of being rewarded for converting fields to timber and providing shade along streams for over 40 years, we've been penalized. Another one says, as more and more regulations and the lack of regulatory certainty incrementally erode the already weak economics of growing trees, more and more timberland will be converted to development. And that is far worse for cool, clean water and riparian habitat. Don't make a bad decision without science and understanding the long-term economics of growing trees. Another one is a professional forester for 60 years, and he's complaining it's got so complicated he doesn't even know how to determine what's fish bearing, what's not. He goes on to say, the steady creep of regulations has a limit. My family will have less tolerance. Another one, and this was actually a real environmentalist. They don't even harvest for income. They just harvest to keep their land in their families. His family has over one-third of the property already tied up in buffers, and they struggle to keep it afloat. One here, I spent 16 years on a forest practice board because I felt positive about the measures taken to protect the environment associated to timber harvesting. However, the process seems to have evolved into an agenda to make growing and harvesting trees uneconomic and difficult endeavor. Forest and fish law has sped up conversions for smalls. I'm converting 5 parcels. Last one, I think it's reprehensible that the Forest Practice Board would even consider this new proposal to lengthen the F stream classification without first living up to the original promises in the forest and fish regulation to smalls. More and greater take of our private property continues to go on. Please reject this proposal. And now Bonnie will read some excerpts that I think is more frank, but also I think really conveys the feeling that's out there amongst our constituency who really don't feel respected and appreciated.
Okay, I'm Dave Robbins. My family has been working this valley since the 1920s. My grandfather railroad logged the valley. My dad started the oyster business, and I did tree farming. My 45-year career working for Hama Hama Company has taught me this. The takers, the really hardcore takers, will never be completely satisfied until they have it all and we are forced off the land. Well, there is always lip service paid to how we really want tree farmers like you on the land. What can we do to help? But it's all just lip service. For 45 years, I've watched our land base get nickeled and dimed away. It's called death by a thousand cuts. The latest huge takings are the steep and unstable rules. I will never stop, it will never stop, and I'm worn out. I'd rather beat my head against a wall than come to Olympia and testify in a totally losing battle. P.S. If you want to hear more, please call.
And he did send me an additional email, which did an analogy about if this happened in some other business or something. I've included that in what you're getting your hand up. I appreciate your attention. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
Yes, Palmer.
Members, Dean.
So I really appreciate you guys coming and making comments, and there's a lot of emotion and heartfelt. But I have to say that I'm personally disturbed by them. You know, policy spent an enormous amount of time working on this issue. You know, lots of commitment by agency staff with the whole intent to properly implement both the rules and the HCP. And they came to greatly a lot of consensus. And I'm not saying this to dismiss your concerns, because I certainly can understand how it can feel if it looks arbitrary to you, and if it looks like people are just wanting to take your trees and your opportunity to harvest. So I do understand that. But what I would like to say is that I think there has been a lot of professionalism amongst all the caucuses in an attempt to come up with an accurate system to properly identify fish habitat. And I don't believe that anybody wants to grab your land or anybody else's land or intentionally make it difficult for you all to stay in business or practice your craft. So I just felt the need to say that. And you have come up here many times and expressed your frustrations about your lack of funding for FREP and for FTP and all those programs. And you know, I take that to heart. You know, I work on it in the legislature. So I wanted you to know that I hear you, but I also want you to know that I don't believe anybody is out to make your lives hard. So.
And I do appreciate that when you're on the other side, even though you may know that that's what it feels like, and the folks that we're working with and trying to represent, they don't understand all of the nuances and details of this. It was a really, really hard sell for small landowners, particularly the Washington Farm Forestry Association, to step up and support forest and fish when we did. The big selling point that Sherry Fox kept pitching, oh yeah, but you'll be protected from the feds. They won't come after you. You'll get regulatory certainty. It doesn't feel that way. It may still be the truth, but it was, I think, yes, quasi science, but it was also a political deal. It was a deal, and when the deal starts working its way upstream, or feels like it's working its way upstream, it feels disingenuous to the people that I represent. And when you read through the letters, they're not factually correct on a lot of stuff. The main thing I'm trying to show is what this group is feeling, and we have, maybe through no fault of anybody's, we've disenfranchised a whole group of folks out there that if you had to attend one or two of our small landowner advisory or annual meetings and hear some of the stories that we just went through last week, it's just unbelievable what these folks have done and are trying to do to try to keep their forest land in forestry. And as Ken mentioned before, we're getting old, and will the next generation take over what we've done, or will they grab the quick bucks? Because that's what we're fighting all the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken and Bonnie. Elaine O'Neill.
Members of the board, I'm Dr. Elaine O'Neill. I'm the executive director of the Washington Farm Forestry Association. So you've heard now from three members representing multiple members. Today I'm going to put on my science nerd hat, and I'm going to focus on the proposal, which sounds like it may have changed last night, not exactly clear on that. That was looking at modifying the terms of the protocol survey and eventual fish habitat model so that it characterizes all habitat with a 20% chance of having fish as de facto fish habitat. Now, in the staff recommendation, it talks about a high probability of potential habitat break, so it's not clear whether this 20% is still in play. But when we're talking about high probabilities, I would say that anything other than 50-50 is violates the principle of shared risk. And certainly, as our members feel, it also pushes more people off the out of forestry and off the land. Is considered a clear case of regulatory creep. I'm not going to talk about regulatory creep, though. I'm going to talk about a little bit about the science of fish and no fish. Obviously, identifying fish habitat relies on a field practitioner being able to identify that break, that fish no fish break, with some reliability. That's difficult enough with the protocol survey tools we have at our disposal. I think it becomes nearly impossible when the dichotomous variable, that fish no fish, becomes 20% fish, 80% fish, something other than 50-50. Notwithstanding this this substantial technical hurdle, it also sets us up for failure further down the road when the data gathered from protocol surveys is used to develop a fish habitat model that accurately characterizes this break on the ground. In order to get a fish habitat model, you need data, a lot of data. You combine that in a mathematical prediction model. The model used for fish no fish would have to be something called a binomial model because we're interested in predicting this dichotomous variable. And if people scratch their heads and say, what's that? It's like, think heads, tails. It's either or. It's one or a zero. And you know, we all know that unless the coin is weighted to cheat, the probability of heads or tails is 50-50. These kinds of mathematical models that work on probabilities, they work best at that probability of 50-50. As soon as you move away from that equal probability, the model loses accuracy. At about 80-20, as was previously proposed, it breaks down. You can no longer use a binomial mathematical prediction model to characterize fish habitat. I found that out the hard way because I got a PhD doing something else. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Claudine Reynolds.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Bernath and the board, for letting me be here with you today. For the record, my name is Claudine Reynolds. I'm the manager of the Wildlife and Fisheries Department of Port Blakely. As part of my job, I work with the company on all matters affecting fish and wildlife habitat and conservation. And I have 16 years professional experience studying wildlife species and their habitats. For the past 12 years, water typing in the Pacific Northwest has been a core function of my team. Over the course of my career, I have surveyed hundreds of miles of streams to determine the maximum distribution of headwater fish. At Port Blakely, we utilize a backpack electrofisher to make these determinations, and we have found the data-rich electrofishing protocol methods to be reliable, safe, and accurate. Although we always start a stream survey in a reach that has known fish use, because of the protocol and professional judgment, very few fish are actually detected. When we are making decisions in the field about the upper distributions of fish and where to hang the end of fish flag, we combine knowledge of fish ecology and stream characteristics with the electrofishing protocol, and that has worked very well for us. I acknowledge the very big decision that you have before you to determine the best path forward in regards to water typing. A lot of smart and very passionate people have been working hard on this issue for a very long time. There's been a lot of progress into where we are today and how far we have come. I'm pleased with that progress that has been made, and I know we're capable of solving these last few pieces. But before any decisions are made to change the protocol, I believe it is paramount that we understand what the implications on the ground will be, and this can't be done without rigorous science and thorough vetting from multiple stakeholder perspectives. If our collective interest is in getting it right and ensuring that the correct conservation measures are being applied to protect fish-bearing streams, a methodology that is scalable to each stream must be sought. As such, it is important for us to begin surveys in stream reaches that have known fish use. A solution that I believe will move this process forward is to support the recommendation of staff, and for you, the board, to direct the Fish Habitat Technical Group to determine the metrics to identify potential habitat breaks. Although it may be determined that additional expertise is warranted in that group, it is currently comprised of scientists and technical experts from multiple stakeholder groups, and I believe that combination of diversity and expertise makes them the appropriate body to analyze the existing data and determine what additional data or analysis may be necessary to make a recommendation to you. I think it would be most appropriate if this technical group reports directly to you, the board. In regard to the proposal to include a probability of fish passage for the type of potential habitat break, I don't believe it is practical or realistic to compare potential habitat breaks from different streams to others across the state as an initial strategy. There are many considerations of what constitutes a habitat break. You've seen this in terms of primary and secondary variables. What may be considered normal or average in one watershed may be completely different in another watershed, or especially another part of the state. It's my opinion that looking at a probabilistic approach to fish passage at the regional or scale level takes away the ability to determine what is correct for each individual stream site specifically. What we need is to focus on producing the most accurate outcome that can be applied to get it right in each individual stream. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Claudine. John Gold.
Members of the board, my name is John Gold. I'm a forester with Sierra Pacific Industries, and I thank you for the opportunity to be before you today. Before I get to what I want to spend most of my time talking about, we heard a lot of thank yous this morning, and I thought one more might be appropriate. Not to discount the contributions of a lot of people in policy and in this room, out of this room, I think it's worthwhile recognizing the leadership of the chair of the board for his dedication to this issue in particular, and bringing together a lot of voices on that. And I don't only say that in the event that I run long on my comments. So we have before us quite a bit of consensus, and I think we need to keep focused on that, that most of what staff and the AMPA have brought to you represents consensus of very diverse viewpoints. My comments today, I want to focus on one of the non-consensus items, the FHAM product. And I bring this to you from a knee-deep or ankle-deep perspective, if you will. I was a forest engineer responsible on one of our tree farms for implementing the RMAP program. We assessed 325 stream road crossings to determine whether passage was appropriate under RMAP. And we did that not just looking at where are the fish now. We charged our biologists with identifying where habitat was. It was a long-term view that we wanted to embrace. And through the FPA and the water type modification process, we had full consultation with other stakeholders, board member Lori, board member for a day Davis, board member Herrera, you know, folks from your agencies and the organizations that you represent were present on the ground on these 325 streams to look at where not just a landowner thought habitat ended, but in their own independent judgment. And I think we need to recognize that there are experts, technical experts, and we need to be able to trust what they've found out there. We are trying to develop a protocol, but it's not a new shot in the dark. We've learned quite a bit over the past 10 and 20 years of doing these kinds of surveys, and there's a lot of data there to work from to help guide the process the rest of the way. So with that said, I'd like to recommend that the board reconvene or continue to utilize the technical group that has made some progress down this path to inform the metrics and the criteria for the habitat assessment method based on what has been learned in recent decades. In contrast, choosing a new rule such as a probability-based rule that other folks have testified on already would call into question the validity of these 325 evaluations, which were on a single tree farm in Western Washington. If we had to go back and redo 20% of those crossings, one owner, one tree farm, we're looking at probably $4 million of additional investment, where, you know, the experts of the very entities represented on this board have already decided that habitat is not present. With that, I'd again like to endorse continuing the work of the technical group and reinforce that the performance targets that are in Forest and Fish should be the bounds in which they're operating and the answers that they bring back to you. And finally, I think I'd like to say if we want to see success out of such a group, if in your wisdom that's the appropriate way to bring this last piece forward, consider what sort of resources in the way of funding or expertise they need. It is a large data set that they have to work with and learn from. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, John. Ray Ans.
Chairman Bonat, members of the board, thank you very much for the opportunity to comment once again in front of you. So, Ray Ants with the Kalispell Tribe and the Upper Pony United Tribes. Actually, like a lot of what Claudine said, it made a lot of sense, and I think that's where policy was trying to strive to go, is to create an opportunity to clean up a messy set of interim and permanent rules into a single final permanent rule. And I don't think that the intent or the understanding of the data and the science leads us to a place that significantly changes what happens on the ground. But the status quo is not perfect, or we wouldn't be here today talking about changes and refinements. And this may be a system that on the west side works much better than it does on the east side. And as an example, we have tributaries that have covered fish species that extend all the way to the perennial initiation point above a permanent natural barrier. So we're talking about, you know, 70-foot straight waterfalls, real permanent natural barriers. And so we have resident fish species that, you know, occupy almost every inch of water in some cases, but that's not in every case either. So having a smart, appropriately vetted method is going to be good. And so I do appreciate and like most of what is in front of you as staff recommendation with a couple of nuances. And I think when you get to the second part of the third bullet under FHAM, when it talks about significant change in habitat, you know, what does significant mean? And I think it's a fuzzy, you know, place to be in assessing data and trying to come up with an answer. We recognize that. It's no better than trying to be 80-20 or 65-35 or 50-50. Those are fuzzy. They're not real, right? Until data informs what that means, they don't necessarily inform us very well, but they give us an idea of how certain we want to be about fish habitat before we start to assess if that is, in fact, the end of fish habitat. So words are important, and I have some suggestions about that last sentence to try to clarify some wording, but you know, I'll leave that to staff if they want to talk about that. But accessibility, I think, is the key here, and it's really looking at changes in habitat, significant or not, that reduce the likelihood of accessibility by fish to a habitat above. And so those are the important parts of how you kind of arrange words and things. So I think we're close, and I think we're not talking about large changes to the system. It's clarification, improving the description of what we do, and having a really significant training program so that when we hit that spot in the field, there's much less variability between those experts when they make this point. So I think we're close. I think we're very close. But one thing that kind of strikes me as interesting, and it's floated around, and I don't know how real it is or not, but this concept of tributary confluences and laterals is kind of a little bit disturbing, and I think we need to be careful in how we assign habitat assessment to those in this process, and that confluences don't always mean there's a change in habitat, and it does not eliminate the need to look at that tributary as being fish habitat. So I'll leave it with that unless there are any questions.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Actually, I do have a quick question for you. Sorry.
No more questions for you.
Right, I know. In this example that you talked about where you've got fish all the way up to the perennial initiation point and above 70-foot waterfall, is there a risk? So I'm thinking about the picture that was laid out yesterday in this consensus FAM, and there's a series of decisions about when you you know, look for fish. Are there breaks below those the permanent natural barrier where someone could say, gosh, I didn't find a fish here, and then so you would say it's not habitat and miss what's well above the permanent natural barrier? I'm just trying to get a sense. I was a little bit, I felt a little bit of alarm that maybe what we were thinking of would miss the situation you were describing.
I think what's critical is, and trying to answer your question, is consultation. And requesting consultation or inferring that that's important as opposed to making it more mandatory kind of solves that problem, because if you consulted the Kalispell tribe on that tributary, you would not need to enter that tributary as a landowner and thus save money, because we have full and extensive fish habitat and fish distribution information for the entire watershed. If you didn't know that, you may waste time and money trying to determine what has already been determined and maybe inaccurate. So I think consultation really is part of this concept that needs to be more formalized and robust. As far as whether or not things exist in the form of habitat or potential habitat breaks above and below a permanent natural barrier, that it does exist both below and above a permanent natural barrier, where you could, with no fish information and implementation of a fish protocol strategy that relies on presence, in the current situation, the fish window is inadequate to detect fish in that particular stream in June. So you would miss a lot of fish habitat in that particular system. If there were no fish information and you were just going in line with the current system.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. Peter Nolan.
Peter Golden, Conservation Caucus. It's really important to remember, after hearing from Ken and Bonnie, that the Forested Fish Habitat Conservation Plan was never intended to be a finished product. It had numerous blanks, defaults, things that needed to be figured out that were going to be put in it. What we're doing today is exactly what was supposed to be done. Remember, we were going to identify water typing through an electronic model, which is not the system we're using right now. That model would predict fish habitat. We're not using it. So for the past, you know, 10, 11 years, we've been using a different system to do it, which involves defaults and protocol surveys. We can't go that direction. So this is exactly what we're doing, is fixing the problem, trying to get to where we were supposed to go. We're not sitting around making up rules to grab land. We're trying to just fulfill the initial 50-year deal. That's what we're doing here. So I think it's a really important principle. So we are in a model, as we know, where fish are, that test fish presence and not potential for fish. And I wish we could be more enthusiastic about this motion, but I think the board can fix this. I think we can live with this until August. But it needs to mention, as Ray just said, something about accessibility of fish. The last sentence just makes no sense. We've read it 100 times. High probability the PHB is coincident with a significant change in habitat, thus the appropriate point to initiate a protocol survey. The issue isn't just whether there's a significant change in habitat. We're not just looking at the ground, we're looking at whether there's a significant barrier to a fish going higher. Would the board please consider including fish accessibility after the terms significant change in habitat? So we're looking at whether there's a significant change in habitat, including fish accessibility. That's the whole point. We have these barriers everywhere. Right now, we're finding little barriers, 5-inch barriers, my technical people say, well, they'll say, well, fish aren't gonna get past there, so we can just start e-fishing above it. Keep going up, keep e-fishing. Don't find fish, they're not there. It's type N. But that's, we need to talk about accessibility in here. This committee, I'm sorry, this expert panel isn't gonna be able to have enough direction without understanding that the board wants them to look at accessibility. I think you're already gonna have to do it in a way, because the next bullet talks about the last, after the comma, the recommendations need to include the metrics to identify the PHBs. So you're saying it already here, need to include the metrics to identify the PHBs. I mean, I know that's kind of a fuzzy way of sort of saying, well, what are those PHBs and to what extent they're a barrier? But why not, why confuse things with the term significant change in habitat? Let's not just sweep this under the rug. Let's put fish accessibility in this motion. That would make things a lot more clear in this motion. So we know we're gonna have a lot of work between now and August to do on this, but let's not get this group off working on the wrong question right away. We need to focus on the elephant in the room, which is how are we gonna treat these natural barriers out in the field? Do we keep e-fishing and finding false negatives and going up? Or are we gonna kind of pause and think about whether, you know, as we restore fish populations, they'll be getting up there. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Kenny Abu.
Thank you, Chairman Bernath, members of the board. My name is Kevin Godbu, and I'm with the Weyerhaeuser Company. Yesterday, I stuck around just to listen to the conversation of the adaptive management process, and we heard a lot about the recommendation of getting back to TFW principles and just basically learning how to get along and use this complicated system. And I liked the board's conversation because I thought there was a lot of enthusiasm. As I thought about what was going to happen today, I thought, well, you know, leadership starts with the board, and it starts today. And it's really up to you to kind of set an example for all of us that are working on these policy issues to try to achieve consensus and to kind of take the passion that we have for these issues and actually take, you know, steps that achieve the maximum amount of consensus we can. And if we come out with a 7-6 or 8-5 vote today, I'd say that's, you know, kind of not where we really want to be. We want to strive to get, you know, a motion or some activity that we can move forward and continue to use. So, you know, your motion today has a lot to do not only with the water typing, but, you know, the bigger conversation about where we want to go with this process. So, you know, keep that in mind. So yesterday we supported and we expressed a lot of support for the FHAM framework. We also expressed deep concern over the unproven metrics and probability concept. It may or may not prove to be useful. We really just don't know yet, and it's an emerging thought that's come up, and it may need some additional study, and it can potentially, you know, provide a path forward, and it may not. And so I think the recommendation on having the technical group actually ask the question, can we have a probabilistic approach to addressing some of these PHBs is a good question. And then if so, you know, what would be the sort of metrics around that? And then what are the implications, both in terms of habitat and economics? That to me seems pretty incremental, pretty smart, and hopefully you'll head in that direction with the staff recommendation. You also heard yesterday, and we heard from staff on sort of the consensus conversation, that protocol surveys will continue to be used as a starting point, and then you kind of walk to the PHB. So we need to ensure that, you know, the role of protocol surveys, you know, gets clarified. And I would just say that, you know, the issue of, you know, the PHB sometimes appears to be confusing to me, because it's potential habitat breaks, and we hear folks talk about accessibility, or we hear about barriers. It's a whole lot of factors, and it's not just barriers. We have barriers out there, but a lot of these streams are in the upper part of fish distribution. You run out of water, the channel just gets narrow. There's a little piece of bedrock that might be 2 feet, there's a big log there. It's not barriers, it's not that easy. And so it is these primary factors that, you know, these technical folks all have to take, and seasonality, things change, and it's a variety of factors. So don't get caught up on one component, accessibility or barriers. I think the primary and secondary factors are general enough and generic, and that's the way we go. So I would just say that, you know, we support as a starting point and a place for you to go the staff recommendations. I think you heard what we were talking about yesterday in terms of the concerns about probability and metrics. And I could offer you up a lot of keywords and amendments that, you know, would make it more acceptable, but I don't think you need to do that. And I would recommend that you not do it, that, you know, to the extent that you can move this thing as is without a lot of metrics, that would probably be preferable. Because, yes, I'd like to see the phrase likely to be used by fish put in there someplace. Yes, I'd like to see clarity around when and how and when protocol surveys would be used. Yes, I'd like to see that there's going to be a field verification component of this before we actually get out. Yes, I'd like to see the clarity about our maps and the implications of a new water typing system to the things that we've done in the past for the past 20 years and what the potential means for having to go back or add new things. Yeah, I'd like to have some better definition of what, you know, high probability and the high level of accuracy means. We could go on and spend days adding those amendments. I think we've got enough in the record, you've got enough with the package to basically move this forward, get it in the hands of the technical folks and start work on it. And you know what, August is just around the corner. We'll be back at this, so we'll have another crack at it then. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Kevin. Adrian Miller.
Good afternoon now, Adrian Miller, Olympic Resource Management. I'll be very brief here. I want to make 2 points here. First of all, I want to make it very clear that I think for nearly all landowners, including our company, electrofishing is a tool that is part of the protocol survey. It is not the survey in and of itself. It is not what determines the regulatory FN break. It is a piece of a sometimes a very complex decision that's made in the field. And so I don't want the board to be left with the idea that somehow electrofishing is the sole tool that is used to determine the FN break. It's part of a system, but not the only part. Second, related to the staff recommendations, I think Mr. Godbu put it very well. This is a clear case of don't let perfection be the enemy of good. I think this is an appropriate, you know, if this were TFW policy, I'd give this a thumb sideways. The board doesn't have that choice, but I think there's a lot of things, a lot of caucuses would like to see in here, but there's also a lot of things in here that can move this to the next stage. Again, I think it was very wise for the staff to recommend that this be put into a board process at this stage, and I think with that, you stand a fairly decent chance of getting a satisfactory resolution on this issue in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Chris Mendoza.
Well, board members, again, thanks again for the opportunity to speak before you. Where to start? Let's see. I guess I'll pick up with the, first clarify one thing. This technical group that folks are referring to, I think it's important that the board recognize there was a fish habitat technical group that met that during the dispute resolution process that was not, well, I don't think it's linked to what the board's referring to. I want to clarify this group of people, which was convened by me, Jamie, Brian Franson, Jason Walter, and the Travel Bios, and Don Naur, came up with the framework that we realized that the alternatives between caucuses were similar to the extent that they all share the same framework. That framework that we agreed to by consensus already had metrics in it. It already said the primary drivers are, and this was agreed to by consensus, permanent natural barriers, channel gradient, channel size, or some combination of them. So that second bullet, to some extent, has already been answered. The proposal that you have before you actually goes against the FHTG. To that extent. It doesn't support it. So I think there's confusion about what this technical group did for policy that has not been presented until now. So I would encourage the board to look at that framework. Secondly, the terms high probability and significant change are ambiguous to the extent that you're going to have a difficult time finding a technical group to agree on what those mean. High probability relative to what? Higher than not probable? That could be, what, 51%? Significant change, is that a statistical significant change? Because if that's what you're talking about, then we could do a study and figure out what that means. I bring these up because one of the big problems with forming technical groups that help support policy decisions is when those policy decisions aren't made and they're punted back to a technical group, when in fact it's a deferment of a decision that needs to be made by another group. And I find it painfully ironic that on the one hand, the board's considering making efficiencies in the adaptive management program based on recommendations from the AMPA, while on the other, they're deferring what are pure policy decisions back to a technical group. It is essentially going to come back later and say, we couldn't agree on what these terms mean. So I would encourage the board to try to refine what you mean by those terms before you hand them off to the AMPA and before he convenes a new technical group, not to be confused with the old one, that will be recommended by policy. Secondly, concerning off-channel habitat, the second bullet, type F non-channelized streams, the edge of OCH is the ordinary high water line. If you put a period there, that would work. The second sentence, it talks about portions of wetlands. That's inconsistent with the current rule and board manual guidance, as I pointed out before, and we'll do again. DNR staff themselves have on record guidance for identifying these wetlands, find the wetland edge, periodically inundated areas of associated wetlands, find the wetland edge. We pointed out that Board Manual 8, that's linked to the rule, says periodically inundated areas of associated wetlands are associated with the wetland edge. If you go to Board Manual 8, it doesn't tell you how to identify a portion of a wetland. It tells you how to identify the edge of the wetland. So anything done to move into portions of wetlands is a rollback on the current rule and linked to the board manual.
Can you please summarize?
Yeah. Finally, I'd like to close with definition from the ecology document on ordinary high water line. And it basically lists, this is from Ecology's documents on common misunderstandings in establishing the ordinary high water mark on streams include, and this is included with my PowerPoint presentation to you, not including contiguous or associated wetlands within the stream ordinary high water mark. Note that it doesn't say not including portions of contiguous or associated wetlands. It says contiguous or associated, meaning the whole thing or to the edge. So in closing, I would encourage the board please not to back away from the existing link between the rule you have in place with Board Manual Section 8. As emphasized previously by DNR staff, that these inundated areas of associated wetlands and fish access actually include the entire wetland. Thank you.
Chris Northcutt. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Bernath, and members of the board for this opportunity to speak. My name is Chris Northcutt. I'm a forester biologist for Merrill Marine Timber Company. I testified last November on the same issue, so some of this will be repetitive, but I think it's important to say it. I have a bachelor's of the sciences in biology, specialized in fisheries. I was TFW trained in 96 for protocol electroshocking. I've been performing protocol surveys since 96 in pretty much every major drainage in Western Washington, focusing mostly on the coast because I live in Forks. Too many arrows on my page. Electrofishing protocol is a highly effective and essential tool for a biologist in their toolbox. I mean, it may even be similar to telling a geologist they can't use LIDAR. I mean, it's a tool. And I've heard it said by other people that were speaking that
There's so many things that go into making a decision on the ground where you put your brake at. The electrofisher is not the tool. It is a tool, but I think it's an essential tool to have out there in the woods. I mean, models are good. They're a great starting point, but I think there should always be the option for a landowner to be able to make that call and have someone go out and check the stream. I mean, out in our area, there's so many small feeder creeks that fall below the rules that you would never know unless you actually had someone out and survey them. And most of them are upgrades. Pretty much, I mean, I'm always available if you have any questions on how I perform surveys. I mean, I can put two or three more pages together about how I come up with a protocol survey, the people I talk to, everything about it. So if anyone ever has questions, I've been doing it for 20 years, call me. So thank you. I wanted to keep it short because other people said the same thing. So thank you.
Karen Twitter. Sorry, I stumbled over your name.
Because you don't know her.
You actually called me by my name.
Good morning, now afternoon, Chair Bernath and members of the Forest Practices Board. For the record, my name is Karen Terlewiger. I work with the Washington Forest Protection Association as a senior forester, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Just want to take us back to what the goal of this process is. And this is the goal that has guided my activities in discussing these issues. We want a scientifically sound, legally defensible water typing system that meets the goals of the Forest and Fish Report and Habitat Conservation Plan, which are highly accurate and to reduce systematic bias or to balance remaining error, and that it is enforceable, implementable, and repeatable. You've heard today and yesterday that policy has come to a lot of consensus about particular elements of that new water typing system. And the staff recommendations, I think, really have in them the request to go ahead with those consensus items, and we strongly support those. The adaptive management system, it may be slow, but it does require science-based decisions. And so we also come in to you the recommendation from the staff that a science and technical group be established, hopefully utilizing some, if not all, of the folks that have been involved in the fish habitat technical group that was talked about by Chris Mendoza, but that those folks really hold the key to helping us move forward in developing a field-based system that meets the requirements of the Forest and Fish Report and meets those requirements that we've talked about before about being enforceable, implementable, and repeatable. The Fish Habitat Technical Group had come to a consensus on what the primary characteristics should be in that discussion, and they are gradient, size, the relationship between gradient and size, and then barriers. If you give them the opportunity to work on those elements and move forward, defining those changes in gradients that deal with potential habitat breaks, and the standard there, the threshold there, is really determining whether or not fish or area is likely to be used by fish. If you allow them to go forward and do that, I think they can provide metrics for the board and metrics for the field-based system that will work. And the board will also be able to assess the implications of those metrics, both on fish use and fish habitat, but also on the economics of the system, which I think you've heard quite a bit about today. WFPA also supports the staff recommendation on optional habitat. We don't believe that the Conservation Caucus's view of non-channelized area is within the current rule and would be a rule change, but we strongly support the staff recommendation. We also support the framework and for the FM and the water type modification point number or point status that you heard earlier in the day. We haven't talked a lot about this, but WFPA is also strongly in support of training for to make sure that the training for the electrofishers and those that do water typing is up to speed. And once a new board manual gets to be created, providing more documentation in that process. So with that, I would like to take just a personal moment to thank my colleagues and also Department of Natural Resources staff and Department of Fish and Wildlife staff and ecology as well. We haven't heard a lot about positive about policy these days, but I will tell you that We've made a lot of progress in this discussion. It's not an easy discussion. We've been having it, the board's been having it for 20 years. So we're moving closer to get to consensus and a new permanent rule. I also wanted to just thank the staff members that work those state agencies because they have worked tirelessly in putting these things together. And I know they've all spent a lot of long nights getting to this point. So thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Jamie Glasgow.
Chair Burnett, board, thank you for this opportunity. Well, if nothing else, I've learned to not sign up to talk before Karen, to go after she goes. So all is not lost. Jamie Glasgow with the Conservation Caucus. I'd like to build on some points that Ray and some others just recently raised, and that is that PHB is this idea of potential habitat breaks. Should be specifically linked to fish passability. I made some comments yesterday, I'm going to revisit some of them because they're relevant here, and that is we can't rely on point in time, present day fish distribution to identify fish habitat as it's defined in 222.16.010. As I mentioned yesterday, that is because of several reasons, including low fish abundance, the fact that there are an estimated 40,000 barriers, man-made barriers to fish passage in Washington state. There are seasonal and annual fluctuations in fish distribution that are well documented in the literature. There are widespread temporary natural barriers that limit fish distribution, and those change over time. Using PHBs as described in policy's FHAM framework addresses this reality if and only if PHBs are defined as having a high likelihood of preventing upstream fish passage. But the staff recommendation definition of a PHB is very broadly defined to include significant changes in habitat, not specific to access. To avoid potential false negatives inherent in protocol electrofishing surveys for the reason I've just mentioned, we need certainty that PHBs are permanent natural features that are likely to prevent fish passage or upstream access of fish from below to above. If I could give a quick example, if you're water typing a stream and you're in the main stem and you know you're in fish habitat, there are fish swimming around your feet, and you're surveying a tributary that comes in, here's a significant change in habitat. So large main stem, a small tributary, that's a change. It's significant. You, under this guidance, could electrofish that tributary one day, not find fish in it that day, and make the argument that it's type N non-fish-bearing waters. You do that during the fish window, the electrofishing window, March 1 through mid-July, and you run the risk, in that example, of missing the fact that that tributary may provide very important fish habitat at other times of the year. And remember, our 010 definition of fish habitat specifically says any time of the year. So tributary habitat like that may be very important for fish that use that habitat during high flows, for example, in December. But we wouldn't know that. And we run the risk there of a false negative and incorrectly identifying type F water as type N. That's our concern. That's a big concern, and that's why we believe that this idea of using PHBs as proposed in this framework really needs to be linked to fish access, not just any change in habitat. So, in conclusion, a responsible board motion, we believe, would direct technical experts to develop PHB metrics that focus on accessibility, not just any change in habitat. And that without that specific guidance to the technical group, we are concerned that this process will not lead to a permanent rule anytime soon. Any questions?
Last one, maybe. Mary, do you want to come up?
Definitely not the best saved for last. I'm really
I just want to say how much I appreciate working with everybody who spoke before, and that just handling these issues is, it's important and it's tough, and not the technical one. I just want to say two things. To follow up on what's been said before about the concern about the success of the technical outcome that's being set up here. Hans reported yesterday that CMR science has been hampered by lack of clear direction from policy. And really, to sum up, the concern that was just expressed by Jamie is that we might be making the same mistake here. So that we haven't narrowed the set, we haven't narrowly defined or exactly laid out the task in a way that's doable, nor have we even narrowed the metrics that we want to rely on. I hope that's not true. Be prepared to be asked for more direction. I wanted to clarify something that was on a piece of the recommendation that has not been addressed, and it's a very small clarification, and that is on the water type mod recommendation that says something about incorporating water type mods into the permanent rule. I'm going to be sensitive to the fact that that language sounds a lot like what we were arguing about in dispute resolution. So if we could refer specifically to the February dispute resolution document that you received that has four recommendations in it, and it specifically says that our discussions established that water type modification established regulatory breakpoints remain subject to the current process for review and potential revision based on new information. In other words, we're not making a change in this regard. There were some associated recommendations for form changes and some other things that I think are important, but I would like to rely on the actual language of the policy recommendations rather than paraphrasing it in a way that might lead to complications later. And lastly, I just wanted to emphasize the reason why we are looking for a simplification in terms of the metrics that we would use in the field. It has to do with what we believe is happening now or creating problems, and that is if we have too many metrics in play, we're really going to we're setting ourselves up for disputes in the field, which I often heard from the tribal folks, the other ones on the ID teams, that this would be an issue. It needs to be clear. So a fish habitat assessment method that is expected to be applied across a highly variable landscape must be as simple and efficient as possible in order to attain repeatability, overall accuracy, cost effectiveness, enforceability, and to be readily implemented in the near future. Further, there is low confidence in the consistency of current or past DNR's water typing review processes. The level of water type modification scrutiny and review agency participation varies by region and with the availability of resources, as evidenced by inconsistencies in allowing the use of protocol e-fishing upstream from anthropogenic barriers and the prevalence of agency tribal no-reply responses and water type mod reviewer comments. The current process has been described as a negotiation between the industry forester and DNR, a complex fish habitat assessment method that relies on a variety of metrics, professional judgment, geomorphic habitat classification determinations, and extensive documentation of possibly an array of physical characteristics and justifications, we believe would place an unreasonable burden on the water type mod review process and would be likely to fail. So we urge that you incorporate that in your thinking around this process and the outcome. Next.
Thank you, Mary. Okay, that completes our public comment period. I say we take lunch. Be back at, try not to go off site and be back by 1:15, please?
Steven.
Sure. Could it be 1:30 so that staff could, I think there's some amendments, that friendly amendments that people would like to make to the motions that we could do during the lunch hour? Or the two motions?
Board members need to do that. Hmm? Board members need to do that.
Okay. Yes.